The idea is you get out of North Ministry, you start your journey, you become a journeyman.
That's the idea.
Okay, let's stay high level, okay? You're getting into too much detail. What changed? Why are you back?
He just kept begging me to come back and like, dude, all right.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today we are joined by Christine Frank, a mentor of yours.
Yes, and a good friend, old friend.
Design architect, is that the... I'm sorry, yep. I should have done my background history. I just know you as Christine.
So. Yeah. We've gone on trips with Christine. She's shown us around New York. And so,
but you're an architect in Denver.
Very long time.
Yeah, sure. I'm an architect and I live in Denver now. I've been here for about 14 years, I think. I am one of those kind of classic architects. I always wanted to be an architect and studied architecture and thought that I was going to go down kind of the very typical path of working in an office and drawing drawings, but fairly early on out of school ended up starting to develop and run academic programs. So the first one was for the then named Prince of Wales and his first American summer school program, which led to going on to New York and being the first executive director at the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art and directing and developing all of our academic programs there, our chapter structure, our first travel programs. I think all of that was really very mission driven, having not had an opportunity myself in school to learn about traditional and classical architecture or to learn about the things that I really loved. And I wanted to make those opportunities available for other people. So I think the first half of my career really was focused on both education, but also sort of nonprofit programming development. Moving out here to Denver was along that same path to set up a new research center in a public university, in a state university. And that would have been, and was in fact, the first research center in a public institution related to traditional architecture. And that was wonderful. We got a new dean who was not thrilled with what our research center was doing. And I could kind of see the writing on the walls. So I gracefully exited and finally returned to practice, which is really, although I'm still doing plenty of volunteer work and speaking, I am really enjoying finally just being an architect. So yeah. And Brent, I'm much closer to your world now. In fact, I'm constantly thinking I should call Brent and ask him how should I build that?
I would love that. I would love that. Anything I can do to repay all the help you gave to me, it'd be great.
Yeah.
There's a number of things I want to unpack here. One, just to tell everybody kind of how Christine and I got to know each other. What year did you start the ICAA, or was it combined? And was that the 90 or 95 or?
Yeah, so I can give you a quick rundown. The Institute starts as the Institute for the Study of Classical Architecture in 1990 or 91. It runs its first programs, 91, 92. I came on as its first executive director in 97. And over the years, it's had many names. One of the things that we did while I was there and on the board was to merge back together with Classical America. So sort of putting the Institute and Classical America back together. And for a while, we were the Institute of Classical Architecture and Classical America. And then we finally became the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art.
I feel like the revival of classicism, and I feel like my role is to teach builders and craftsmen about classical architecture, right? And my voice is, because I've been a builder and a craftsman, that sharing of that information of how to build a mantle, door headers, pediments, porches, needs, they, you know, we've forgotten that language, and I feel like I need to share that. I love hearing how recent, relatively, you starting that because this is not something that has been around. It was forgotten for a long time. And so there's a number of ICAA chapters. I was the president of the Texas chapter. Crazy pathways, me getting there. But for a lot of our listeners and a lot of our people, this is fairly new stuff. This is fairly recent that this revival has taken place. Yeah. And I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And Brent, I think there's this is maybe a little bit outside of the Passion for Craft realm, but not really, because I think it's important to recognize that what is happening right now, and by right now, I would say since the early to mid 80s and 90s. So that decade right there is really important. It's when Seaside is developed. It's when now King Charles runs his first summer program. So I think there were some torchbearers like Classical America and Henry Hope Reed, who were a very limited number of people. I think the tradition of traditional and classical architecture maintained, I think, most strongly in the Southeast. But then in the 80s and 90s, partly, I think, emerging out of postmodernism and a re-interest in the past, we see this newest renaissance. And I would really call it a renaissance because, you know, it is a rebirth of ideas made fresh and new again. And yeah, I would date that in urbanism. And that's the part I mean is maybe a little outside of the Passion for Craft, but not really, because it's about how we build communities. Yeah. So, you know, my role as architect, your role as craftsman, builder, and designer, and the urbanist's role of creating the landscape in which all of what we do comes together. It's one whole big revival.
Yeah.
And it has to be. We've done a whole episode on new urbanism and what it looks like to have not just a building that, you know, speaks to the past, but, you know, a full community that works together towards creating something beautiful. So
walkability.
Right, yeah. There with you.
So yeah. it goes back again to our path. I start taking classes at the ICAA probably late 1990s, well, probably is actually early 2000s. And then I begin to understand classicism. I'm taking these proportion classes. I'm going to New York. I probably went to four different classes and learning about this and kind of putting all this together. At the same time, in 2004, I wrote my book on historic millwork. And then I got approached by somebody to be the official licensee for Architectural Interiors at Winter Tour. And so that led to a publisher coming to me saying, hey, do you want to write a book on Winter Tour? And so I was like, sure, that's great. Well, I started going into these rooms and I really wasn't sure what I was looking at. And I was
I remember.
And
yeah.
I was like, okay, this is Georgian, I know, this is federal, but what in the world? And so I reach out to Christine and through Pete, I think, how we kind of, and she graciously came along beside me and really walked with a hand in hand through Winter Tour explaining what was happening. And so that's where our friendship started. We went to New York, walked around with her, with all the kids. I mean, she knows my family, she knows everybody. So that was a fun time as I remembered that. And going through and looking at those rooms and kind of you explaining that was the early part of our friendship.
Yeah. I think, you know, Brent, that's so much of what really underpinned the work I did at the Institute. In many ways, it was really just helping people to see the classical language of architecture and how it runs through time and has these commonalities through time and differences. And seeing that as a root of much, not all, but much of American traditional architecture and all the different kind of styles and traditions that we work in and that we have at our fingertips to pull from today. Yeah, like I think about teaching like the AIBD guys, the American Institute of Building Design. I say guys because they're mostly guys. There were a few women in there. Watching the light bulbs come on when you relate to someone that, you know, if you look at that thing you call a casing, you, Mr. Builder, call a casing around the door, and then you look at a classical order and you look at the architrave or the beam, what's happening there? This thing that's spanning the opening and in an analogous way holding the opening up, yeah, that's the same thing as the beam. And by the way, if you look really closely, the shapes are all the same, you know? So I think there's just, it's like the scales fall from your eyes at a certain point and you can see the language and you can see the pieces and parts. And then you can see how they're different at different times. Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, I find it inspiring too. I find that, you know, looking at the way they used to build is, and especially the way we aren't building today, it's just, it's inspiring. So the other piece I want you to share for us, because I think it demystifies the architect and architecture today. I know a lot of builders and craftsmen can be intimidated by the architect and what the architect knows, the separation between design and building.
Why are you so scary?
Your journey, right? I mean, at UVA and the modernism, and then, you know, I think it was your love. You grew up near Williamsburg or in Williamsburg. Mm-hmm. If you hadn't had that love for, you know, traditional building and stuff, you know, I don't know if you could have made that path that you made, but you, you know, were trained as a modernist, really, right? And then kind of love of classicism, how did you get there? How was that path?
Well, you know, it goes back to something we were talking about just a moment ago, and that is the state of our communities in this country and, you know, sadly around the world as well. Yes, I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia. So I grew up surrounded, you know, a small town. It's bigger now, surrounded by beautiful buildings, beautiful landscape, materials. There was sort of materiality to the architecture, the wood, the brick, the way that those materials naturally sort of fit their forms and their purposes. And then went to architecture school. And at the time, you know, UVA, I think, was a very typical kind of mainstream architectural program. In the mid 80s to 1990, when I graduated from with my undergraduate degree, it was still very much a kind of Bauhaus inspired and Bauhaus influenced program. I think I learned valuable lessons related to kind of graphic design and design principles. But as one of my colleagues here, the former dean at CU Denver, Mark Galernter, pointed out once, why don't focus on learning the principles, just focus on learning the architecture, you know, like don't spend your time learning about repetition or transformation by looking at things that aren't related to architecture. Learn about those things, but learn about them through architecture, with architecture sort of being the model that of what you're looking at. So Brent, while I was in school, my parents moved up to Northern Virginia, and I was just shocked that this profession I was going into had built and in my view was responsible for the creation of this suburban environment that was just very detrimental to my family's life. My father suddenly was spending 2 hours a day commuting. We didn't know our neighbors. I couldn't ride my bike anywhere anymore. Hmm. You know, it was just the complete antithesis of Williamsburg, which was basically a good traditional town. Along about that time, I started to learn a little bit about some of the new urbanists that were doing their work. And I got very interested with the basic idea that there were really valuable lessons in the past, and why weren't we learning from those? Hmm. And I'm not at all interested, and I'm maybe even more radical about this now than I was in the past. I am not interested in recreating something from the past, although I also don't think there's any problem with doing that. Like, I don't have a philosophical problem with creating something that looks exactly like it did in the past. I think that's totally fine. But I'm really interested in the ways that our huge body of architecture, craft, urban design traditions have lessons for us. And we don't need to make up new answers to the lessons. You know, we can look at the past, learn from it, and those lessons can be used to solve really critical problems that we have today about how we build community, how we make things that are in harmony with our natural environment, with our social environment, and how we make things that are beautiful and that please people. So,
mm-hmm. So you know, I wanted you to tell that because I think that when I tell people, like, no one... There's not really anybody on our jobs that really understands classical principles. And I'm encouraging builders and craftsmen to know how to build a mantle, to understand how to build a porch, because to look to the architect sometimes and their, or the designer, they oftentimes don't know and weren't trained. And so mm-hmm. now you have transitioned into, I know you're doing architecture, but you with building houses. And so, you know, you came much into our world. Tell us about that journey and, you know, working with craftsmen, working with builders and kind of, you know, that full circle for you.
So I started out working with the wonderful Alan Greenberg when I graduated from the University of Notre Dame. I had previously worked for architects in high school and, you know, had always been working with architects.
And Alan Greenberg's classical architect.
Yeah, one of our greatest classical architects in the United States. Hmm. Retired now from practice and just a wonderful human being and an extraordinary architect. Anyway, so I kind of cut my teeth at the highest level, I would say, of classical architecture. First learning at Notre Dame directly from Thomas Gordon Smith, and then working with Alan and or under Alan, learning from him. And then when I left and started sort of doing some of my own work, I mean, Brent, it was really kind of shocking. Like, I didn't realize that many homeowners get to the architect, if they ever get to an architect at all, through a builder. I thought everyone came to the architect and, you know, I had a very kind of super high-end kind of distorted view of how most architecture happens in this country. And then I did my first house of my own, and it was for Rodney Cook in Atlanta, and it was on a property that he was developing in Buckhead. And I only designed the house sort of through what we would call DD, or design development, and then they took it from there. And I learned a lesson there, which is that I don't want to let go of my projects too early, and the role of the architect during construction is really important. Rodney did a great job executing it. It's a lovely house. And of course, the nice compliment is no one knows that it was built in, you know, the 1990s, early 2000s. And then I did my second house all on my own, ground up, and that was Chatsworth Cottage for Jeff Davis. I mean, just a
beautiful,
remarkable
house.
Opportunity house. And remarkable trust from him to me. I had no idea really what I was doing. I really didn't know how to put together a set of construction documents. I didn't even know what needed to be in a set of construction documents. And this is a really interesting thing where our worlds kind of intersect, because on, you know, on your build side, and that is that I realize how much of architecture is about communication. So I've got an idea. I've got to somehow abstract that and put it into drawings. And those drawings have to communicate to the builder how to build everything. I've also got to communicate to the client what it's going to look like. I typically do that through a lot of quick little, you know, hand perspective sketches. Mm-hmm. And then during course of construction, you're still in this communication process of, you know, so it's a funny thing, because this very physical, real thing that you end up building is this layers of abstraction from the first germ of an idea through to when it finally becomes a real thing.
So in this podcast, we're a lot about talking to directly to the builder. And a lot of what we focus on is residential work, not necessarily mm-hmm. commercial work. What it feels like today, a lot of the architects that are coming out of architecture school are really just focused on the commercial side and don't necessarily go into the residential side, or it's just they're very rare in comparison to the other.
Yeah.
Can you speak to as to why that is and where, like, from an architect's point of view, like, why you think people don't necessarily go the residential route as much as they try and chase the commercial route?
Well, I think part of it is that so many of our houses don't have an architect involved. That doesn't mean they don't have a designer involved at some point, but, you know, first of all, if you look at our houses broadly across the nation, most homeowners buying, whether it's a single family home or a duplex or a multi-unit, they go right to the developer who is offering a product. You maybe get to make a few choices in what your kitchen cabinets are and what your tile is. And somewhere along the way, an architect or engineer has likely drawn up and those plans and the structure. And that's how the majority of our country buys their houses. Mm. And then they sell them 7 years later. The average length of American home ownership is 7 years. So the number of opportunities, I think, for a homeowner to go directly to an architect to design their home and the time that that takes and the money that that takes. Now, I mean, I think if you have a good architect, ultimately you're saving time and money working with a good architect because the architect is going to be able to put everything together for the homeowner fairly quickly. But a custom home is not within the reach of everyone. I mean, I really admire a lot of my New Urban architect colleagues who have done a lot of really good kind of pattern book houses that make good quality architecture available for someone without them having to go a fully custom route. So
cool.
I think one of the reasons there's more commercial focus, I mean, even like if I go to get information from the AIA, my contracts from the AIA, and there's a new one recently for custom residential work, but the contracts are suited to commercial work. They're really not suited to residential work. And I just think that's market share. I just think there's more commercial work, more money for architects in that work. And somehow also maybe it's architects have abdicated a little bit their role in the design of homes.
So I think where I was going, I was asking about BIM and this architect was saying that the role of the architect was changing because of these 3D modeling, the way buildings are built, that, you know, the HVAC drops his stuff, the plumber drops his stuff, and that coordination and the role of the architect was changing. Do you see that at all? Or do you, is that your experience or?
If anything, Brent, I think in some ways the architect's role is going back in some ways to what it has been in the past. I mean, if an architect was kind of the clerk of the works, right, sort of running everything, including the building, the architecton, including the building part of things, it has always, I think, been the role of the architect to bring everything together. So, you know, if you start with a design for a building, and then you've got to put all of these things together that make that function. So you have all of the kind of circulatory systems of the building, right? The lungs of the HVAC, and all of the things that that's a part of, the, you know, filtration of the air, or how much the walls and windows breathe or don't breathe, the sunlight that you're incorporating into the building, technologies that I may not have special expertise in, but that I might know I want to incorporate in my building. And so I'm going to bring in a consultant to work on that. Like, I'm working with some fantastic MEPs right now on a small institutional project that I'm doing, and I wouldn't be able to do what they're doing. I'm interested in bringing all that together in a way that fits. And so, for example, if I'm sharing my base drawings with them, so that they have something to work from. I don't work with Revit. I still work in AutoCAD in 2D, which I think is, you know, because I learned to draw and draft with a pencil and a T-square and a parallel, I think I'm just kind of more comfortable with that. I know that, I mean, there are, I think, interesting things happening with AI, and frankly, I'd be perfectly happy if I could tell my AutoCAD program, hey, here's what my wall section is going to be. And here's my sketch of the floor plan. Now you go draw it up for me. But then I'm going to come back and work all of that. Because for me, right. And I think, Brent, this is part of my evolution as an architect. I am super interested in how things go together and how they get built and built well. And then how that relates to what the forms look like. And vice versa. I think I used to work sort of from the outside in, like I would design what I wanted it to look like, and then I would figure out how to build it. I'm a lot more interested now in working with the materials at hand and their characteristics and working sort of back towards the forms, because I think that's a more authentic architecture.
Well, I don't think
it changes it that much.
Well, actually. I think one of our last conversations, I think I remember this right. You were asking, hey, what do you think about me getting my builder's license? Yeah. And I think the ultimate model should be that the architect is a builder and the builder understands design and architecture. They don't need to be separated like they have been, where the builder's subservient to building whatever the architect draws. And sometimes that can't be done. So I'd love it. Love it. And I told you this. I love that you want to go get your builder's license. I think that's important. I think that makes you a better architect. I think your buildings will be better. Right? I mean, that's the revolution and return, the renaissance I would like to see.
Yes. And I think, Brent, this is something that is, I think, maybe different with architecture today. Cameron, my partner, he is an architect and a builder. And he operates as a small developer. So he purchases a property, designs a new house, takes the old house down and builds a new house speculatively and sells it. In one way, he's lucky. He doesn't have to work with clients. In another way, he's impoverished. He doesn't get to work with clients. Mm. I feel like I have learned so much from him about how construction occurs and how it is sequenced. It really has changed my ways of thinking about what I design and thinking through it from the builder's perspective. And I don't like the idea that the architect just sort of designs everything and gives you this, and then what, the contractor is just like this automaton who, I rely on the builder right now to know how to put details together well and to make sure that they can read the drawings and that their mason knows how to lay brick well. And, there's that aspect of our industry and our craft today. And that is such a loss in building trade skills and skilled craftsmen that, I'm out there 2 weeks ago showing the mason how to butter a brick.
Oh, no.
I think architects should be building more on the contracting side. And I think, there is a big tradition in this country, and the majority of houses are not designed by an architect and built in a traditional sort of design, bid, build fashion. Mostly homeowners are going directly to a builder. And so this is where I think, what you're doing in helping to educate your builder and your architect audience, frankly, about, how to design things well, I think is so important, Brent.
So Christine, what do you think?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Christine, what do you think? How do we make the switch, right? How do we take it from where we are today to where we want to be, which is where the architect has a bigger hand involved, where the builder doesn't just go, I've done 1,000 of these houses. I've got an A, B, and a C house. Which one do you want? Because obviously time and money become, one of the factors that a lot of people are dealing with in all that. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because, for example, there are details I would like to do. Like I would like, when I'm installing siding and using siding, I'd like to have that installed in a rain screen application rather than just planting it on the Tyvek, for example. But the minute that I try to do a detail that is a little bit different than the standard average way of building it, the contractor looks at it and I think puts a factor on and says, oh, this is going to be 20% more.
Yeah.
Or like, I just had a struggle on a project where we want to use water locks. We, being the architect owner team, want to use water locks to finish their herringbone wood floor. We're going to be putting in this beautiful quarter sawn white oak herringbone floor. We do not want to put, and I'm not going to mention any other names when I say what we don't want to use, but we don't want to use what every single flooring contractor has said, oh, we proudly use this one product. We want to use water locks. I know I have used it before. I love it as a product. The battle to try to get the flooring contractor or subcontractor to utilize the product that we want to use, which I would say goes in that, like, it's a traditional product, right? Yeah. It's a traditional product, traditional application. It requires, I think, a little bit more skill to apply than just, you know, something that dries in an hour. It's a huge battle. So how do we change that? Some of it, I think, is maybe a closer alliance between the architect and the builder from the outset of the project. I think for, if it's going to remain, you know, a kind of more traditional relationship where there's an architect and a builder, mm-hmm. As two separate entities, I think having that team up earlier in the process helps both with schedule, which has a monetary impact. Mm-hmm. And it also helps give the owner a clearer idea from the beginning of where costs are. So I think that's one specific way that we could change how we work together, rather than the architect designing everything and then turning it over to the builder and suddenly it's twice as expensive as what the owner wants.
Right.
And then you're redesigning everything to a budget. I think there's that. I think part of the problem I think we face a little bit is the kind of litigiousness and working within our building codes. So I think it's a struggle to do, to get sort of unique details built or to use materials in a way that we know works because right. they're traditional applications, but that may seem unusual, for example, to an inspector.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times traditional materials have a 100-250 year history of proven success. Efficacy. Yeah. Cause like you're saying, like with siding on a house, well, where does my J channel go? We're not using right. J channel, you know. There's strapping, and that's what we're going into. Not, yeah, that it's a whole.
When I look at Colonial Williamsburg, and I look at the way we used to build, having been at North Bennett Street, I can get very discouraged about the state of craft. Okay, but then I look at some of the things that we're able to build, and some of the things that are being designed, and I'm like, well, maybe, maybe we're actually. If the 1970s were the low point, 1980s with McMansions, maybe because of Seaside, because of new urbanism, we're actually in a renaissance in some ways. Where would you land on that? Because I can speak out of both sides of my mouth and be discouraged, but also be optimistic.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Brent, I feel very positive about where we are and how much has changed for the better. I think both in terms of quality and quantity of classical and traditional architecture today that's new, as well as the sort of huge growth of practitioners. As I think you know, because we talked about this a little bit in Williamsburg, I chair the American chapter of INTABAU, which is the International Network of Traditional Building Architecture and Urbanism. So this is the international network. So around the world, there are, I think we have 40 something chapters, 40 different countries represented. South America, just about every continent around the globe, we have a chapter base there. And what I see out of that is that architects and builders and individuals, not just professionals, but lay people also around the world, understand and are seeking out knowledge of traditional ways of building because they're using mostly sort of low-tech materials, things that don't require huge amounts of carbon to transform them into our building materials, for example. They're using mostly local earthen-based materials, natural materials. There's a huge natural building movement in the United States that I was unaware of before I moved to Colorado. The Natural Building Alliance, for example. There's a, you know, these are things that I think your typical classical architect would think, well, what does that have to do with me? I think it has everything to do with classical and traditional architecture. These kind of low-tech building methods are the ways that we built all of the architecture that we admire from the past. So I feel really positive because I see from when I started, and I'll tell you, I'll give you a specific story. Leonard Porter, who was with us when we wandered all around the Met that day,
yep.
Leonard Porter and I did a conference in Seaside in maybe 2000 or 2001, something like that. Might have been late 90s. And I gave a lecture on contemporary classical architecture, which I've given a lot of lectures on that now. But that was my first one. And I wanted to only show built work in the lecture. And it was so difficult to find projects that weren't on a drawing board, but that had been actually built, that I really struggled to go through and find enough projects to fill like a 45-minute lecture.
Wow.
It's the exact opposite today. If I go and give a lecture on contemporary classicism, I mean, I don't know, how do you edit that? I mean, there's so much. We're really lucky in the U.S. We have the Institute, we have the CNU, we have Notre Dame, North Bennett Street, American College of the Building Arts. Now we have new schools, Catholic, Benedictine, Utah Valley University. I mean, we have so many programs around the country and so many practitioners. The growth of our Institute chapters have been really important in plugging people in. So I feel extremely positive. I think we all have to keep, you know, upping our game and staying at a really high level of what we're doing, and not just making it about style.
Yeah, I think it's a beauty thing for me. Like those traditional and classical things are, I believe, more beautiful than, you know, contemporary modernism. And that's a great argument in and of itself. I find that homeowners are attracted to that, and these little things I do on Instagram are drawn to that. I didn't know what was wrong. Oh, I see it now. Yes, that's so much better. That's more beautiful. And there's a beauty argument. You don't even have to get into classicism and things like that. It's just, that's more beautiful. And we are building ugly buildings today. And I think that the classicism, traditionalism is beautiful naturally. And you can go into all the reasons why, but I think it's almost easy enough to just say it's more beautiful and people go, yeah, no, that's true. I get it.
I think that architecture and the built environment, and I think our material culture is really complex. I mean, it's so multi-layered with ideas. People project what they want other people to see about them by what they wear or what their house looks like. Institutions project an image by the architecture that they choose to represent them. These things are laden with history and with cultural narratives. Right. People have different taste. Some people really find modernist-derived architectures beautiful. I find some modernist architecture kind of serene.
I agree with that.
In a kind of minimalist sense, it's calm. I don't know how I would live in it. I wouldn't. I mean, look, you know, I've got all my ornament. I love ornament, but it's very complex. It's not a simple thing. And one thing I thoroughly and completely reject is the idea that we must do one thing or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that contemporary classicists do themselves no favors whatsoever by saying what we do is good and what everybody else does is bad. I just think that is just completely wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
Part of the ICAA is the New Vitruvian. Is that right? Is that their new?
Yeah, the New Vitruvians. Yeah.
What is that group? Because we had a representative come and talk to us about that, and I was like, oh, cool. Seems fun. But
I haven't heard of that. What is that?
Well, so a lot of the chapters have started, and I'm not on our national board anymore. I'm just kind of a member now, which is nice. But a lot of the chapters and our national office really encourage the starting of kind of young chapters. And I think it's maybe not PC to use it to call them young professionals. So a number of chapters have emerging classical architects. And I think our New England chapter has the new Vitruvians or the young Vitruvians. And one of the things that the Institute has pioneered, just as I was rotating off the board, is I think two really important programs. One is the New Heights program, which I think you might have had a version of in
They did
Texas.
It down in San Antonio. Michael Lember's office was big in pushing that.
So this is reaching out to school age, like elementary, middle and high school age.
Oh, really neat.
Teaching them craft. Right?
Yeah, and teaching them about architecture. And then also, really, this has been, I think, under Michael Mesko's direction, taking the Institute to schools of architecture and doing like a crash course in classical architecture. All the students attend. They're going to be doing one at Cornell. There's a new group at Cornell that has been having some lectures and discussions about contemporary classicism. And I know they were very excited. I told them that they should have the Institute come and do their program in the university, and they're really excited about that. All of this is to say, I think, Brent, going back to your question about you can feel kind of depressed. I mean, it is depressing when you realize that like a guy who's a mason doesn't know how to lay brick. but at the same time, we have at least a lot of architects now. And I think the craft part of that has to come along as well. And I think a lot of the preservation world, I think what I see a lot of is a lot of siloing. So when I'm building something new, I often will look at preservation briefs on what a traditional way of building something would have been. And I will apply that to my new design problem. The preservation world, preservation architects, preservation knowledge, the building world, for example, there's the Keep Craft Alive initiative. That is something that, yes, we need to keep our building crafts alive. But all of these things are operating as if the other things don't exist. Hmm. So the classical architects are teaching about architecture, and God love them, the American College of the Building Arts is doing what they're doing. And the Keep Craft Alive initiative is trying to go, but it's so segmented.
Yeah.
Even like the new urbanists don't see what they're doing as kind of linked together with traditional methods and means of building buildings. So I think this is something we need to work on, is less siloing. And that's a big part of Intibau, because our mission is building architecture and urbanism.
Well, I think we're getting close on time. Thank you for coming and sharing. Aww. and you know, it's great seeing you, and I love your perspective that you're helping share to our audience. It's just, it gives us great perspective, and so I appreciate that.
I'm your biggest fan.
You're so sweet.
Well, I haven't piped up yet here on the podcast, but I'm just kind of sitting back and listening to the experts. But the book that you did with Brent, Traditional American Rooms, very helpful, beautiful book. And I just want to ask, like, what's your favorite room in Winterthur?
Oh, goodness.
What's your favorite child?
I think I'm going to forget the name of it, but Brent, do I recall correctly that one of the rooms is by Asher Benjamin?
Yeah, that would be the Federal Parlor. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think something that so interests me is early American architects adopting classical architecture, because they make it look like something that has never looked like before. I think it's maybe not right to call it naive, because it isn't. It's very carefully studied, but it's just so free in what they were doing. I love that. So
a lot of interpretation, like,
yeah,
like we always talk about, like you put, you know, like the Ionic part of the capital that comes out, a lot of people stylize that to, like, if you're a rancher, you'd have like a longhorn on it or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that is in the nature of classical architecture and always has been. Hmm. So yeah. We need to keep doing more of that.
Yeah, awesome. That's cool. For sure. Christine, great seeing you. Love
great
it.
Great to see you too.